Hello and welcome to Technically Legal. This is podcast 25. I'm your host, Dominic Rabia, and with me today are
Ben Snitkoff
and David O'Brien.
We've got three stories for you this week. First, we're talking about the Bilski arguments that recently came before the Supreme Court. Then we're talking about the ACTA internet provisions, where ACTA is the anti-counterfeiting trade agreement. And finally, we're talking about Facebook and how it can be used for alibi the next time you commit a robbery. Or anyone else does, for that matter. Let's dive right into our first story, which is the Bilski arguments. Bilski, which is the case we've been talking about for quite a while on this podcast, recently actually came before the Supreme Court and was argued at 1 p.m. on November 9th. A couple of things came out of this argument. First of all, the judges don't really seem to think much of the actual invention of Bilski, which, to remind you, is basically a system of amortizing risk. Is that correct? Or
hedging commodity risk, I believe.
Yeah.
So none of the judges seem too impressed about it. And I guess the first question is why?
Mostly because it's not a machine. It's not. So there's a case a while back now called Diamond v. Chakrabarty. And in that case, it's where we get most of our current jurisprudence as to what is and what isn't patentable. And that case was about a specialized bacteria that could digest oil from oil spills. And the Supreme Court said everything under the sun made by man is, you know, eligible subject matter for a patent, you know, ignoring as to whether or not it's novel or whether it's non-obvious. If it's made by man and it's under the sun, you know, you guys can patent it. But this is, it's just a process that somebody does. It isn't a machine, it isn't an invention, it isn't a creation, it's just something that you can do. You can sit down and work it out on a pen and paper.
And the Supreme Court, for that reason, was not impressed, because they figured, hey, if we can work it out on pen and paper, so could anyone else. Why is this thing being patented? So is that the end of Bilski? Is it just going to be that the Supreme Court's going to rule against it and say this shouldn't be patentable by, or is there a chance they're going to make a wider ruling that will have greater impact on patent law in general for decades to come, potentially?
At the very least, my feeling is that they would not have taken this case, what they call granted cert in this case, if they didn't want to resolve at least the issue of the standard that the Federal Circuit uses to analyze these cases. So in Bilski and the Federal Circuit is a court of appeals that's it does mainly patent cases, and it can take cases from other places, but it's mostly patent cases.
And let's talk about the standard that the Fed Circuit used.
It was
the machine or transfer standard. And do you want to go into detail on that, Ben, or Dave?
How about Dave does it?
Well, sure. I mean, what this case really gets at is what exactly is patentable subject matter. And the way that the statute is written currently, any new or useful process is potentially eligible for a patent. And as you pointed out, Ben, with that with the Chakrabarty case, which goes back to the oil eating bacterium, we're talking about whether or not abstract principles can be patentable, and the case law now suggests that they certainly cannot. And the argument that's sort of presented here is that we're talking about a business process, and a business process is not patentable because it's an abstract idea, or at least those are the arguments that are sort of before the Supreme Court. And in the Bilski case, as it went before the Federal Circuit, which is at the appeal level, they devised this test that we now call the machine or transformation test. And it basically states that in order for a process such as this to be patentable, it needs to either have some sort of transformation in terms of either the state of matter that it's in, or it needs to be transformed into some new thing, or it needs to touch a machine in some way in terms of how the process is implemented. And that sort of has far-reaching impact on the way that the concept of patentable subject matter might be applied to new technology concepts. And we've talked about this in previous weeks. That's why this impacts whether or not software is potentially patentable. Is that a good rundown, or do you guys have anything to add?
Yeah, it's a solid rundown. So just sort of recap, the subject matter of a patent is basically what the patent tries to patent, to put it in really simple terms, I guess. And the machine or transformation test basically, as Dave, needs to be either time regular machine or transforming something physical. You can't just do a mental process and try to patent it. This is what the Federal Circuit, which is the court of appeals that generally deals with patents, ruled. Now the Supreme Court is reviewing that decision. And the justices actually had a pretty interesting dialogue with the attorneys on both sides. For example, Justice Sotomayor asked whether she could patent a method of speed dating, and the answer came back, potentially, which maybe is a good or bad thing.
Well, it was interesting. I mean, so in the petitioners, of course, presented their oral arguments first, and it was argued by Attorney Jakes. Is it J. Michael Jakes? Is that the attorney's name for the petitioners?
Yes. The petitioners being the people who want to see Bilski with a patent.
Right, right. So during his oral argument, almost immediately, and you can read the transcripts, I think we posted them on our blog on Monday. It's a fascinating read, by the way. It's 63 pages, and I blew through most of it in under a half hour. I found it pretty compelling. Anyways, during oral argument, within, I think, the first few minutes, immediately almost all of the justices started peppering Mr. Jakes with questions and hypotheticals. And they would propose, well, what if I came up with this? Why would this be patentable under this metric that you're suggesting? And the answer that Mr. Jakes came back with a bunch of times was, well, yes, potentially. And I think his fallback position was that, yeah, that the processes such as something like a concept like speed dating, like Justice Sotomayor suggested, is potentially patentable, but it probably would fail under the guise of obviousness, which is another one of the components that you need to meet, because any new or useful process is eligible for patent, but also has to be novel and non-obvious. And so I think with the problem with a lot of the hypotheticals that the justices did suggest, as Mr. Jakes correctly pointed out, was that a lot of the hypotheticals were obvious and they would not have been granted patent, but they were definitely potentially patentable.
Right. To give you another example of one of these absurd hypotheticals that the judges threw out, Justice Breyer asked if he could possibly get a patent on a method of teaching antitrust law to students that kept 80% of the class awake. And again, the answer was yes, that's potentially patentable. And I'm going to disagree with David on one thing briefly. I think a lot of these issues would be novelty, like speed dating. Justice Sotomayor didn't make speed dating. It's not that speed dating was inherently obvious. In fact, I think if you were the first person to invent speed dating and tried to patent it, assuming we're ignoring as to whether or not it is patentable, which it probably isn't, like subject matter wise, I think it would have been not obvious because it. I thought it was pretty novel. I mean, it's a very interesting way of attacking an issue like that.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly meets the novelty standard, I would think, presuming it hadn't been invented yet.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, that's a really good point. What it probably comes down to is the way in which the inventions or the hypothetical inventions that the justices were discussing are actually implemented in terms of trying to defeat it for either novelty or for non-obviousness. But certainly the fallback position that Mr. Jakes took multiple times during oral arguments was that a lot of the hypotheticals were obvious inventions that they were proposing.
Yes, and I think that was to his detriment. If he had taken a harder line and if he had tried to elucidate some line as to what is patentable and what isn't patentable, what is a law of nature and what isn't a law of nature, what's something that totally happens, what's a totally mental process, which is generally not patentable, versus what isn't, I think he may have been able to gain some ground, but he didn't do that. And as a result, and I've said this before, my prediction is going to be that they're going to overturn the patent. They're going to say that, you know, that wasn't patentable subject matter, and they're going to say that the machine and transformation test isn't the appropriate test to use. It's something more broad, or it's something different. But that the Federal Circuit is being too narrow in saying that that's the only way you can determine whether or not something is patentable.
Oh, maybe I'd be really interested to hear what you guys think of what the exact problem is with the machine or transformation test as it stands today. Why is that an imperfect metric to determine whether or not something is eligible patent subject matter?
I think it's simply too narrow, in that not everything patentable has a machine or a transformation. And you have to sort of really contort the nature of your invention to try to make it go through those hoops. if you don't naturally have a machine or transformation. It seems, I think, Judge Newman on Newman? Yeah,
I think that's the right name.
Yeah. Judge Newman had the, basically, her argument was that this is kind of trying to put patents back into the industrial age, and we've kind of moved beyond that. And there's stuff that isn't necessarily tied to a machine or even a physical transformation. I just think it's too narrow, and it constrains patents based on what people can easily think of with a machine or transformation.
Right. I agree generally with Dominic, and I'm having a tough time. I mean, I'm not a big fan of software patents, as we've discussed before. So if we take software patents out of the equation, I'm struggling now to think of something that I think should be patentable or would be patentable under the Patent Act that doesn't fall into the machine or transformation test. But the failing that the Federal Circuit has previously had is that it consistently comes out with tests that are too narrow and don't comport with previous Supreme Court precedent. That's where the Supreme Court grants cert on a case, smacks the Federal Circuit upside the head, and remands it down, either with a new test or reinstating whatever the old test was.
And I think also, didn't the justices point out that in some circumstances under the machine or transformation test, you could have a, for instance, a old computer hardware or an old computer from, say, back in the 80s, like a Commodore 64 or something, whereby if you implement new software onto an old machine like that, then you potentially, under that metric, have a new machine and therefore a new patentable invention. Did you guys follow that at all in the oral argument?
Possibly, assuming you get past novelty, which would probably, unless it's something amazingly different, it seems like novelty would bar. I mean, if you're just implementing something that was patented years ago and the patent's expired and now you're just doing it on a new machine, well, you're not really doing anything new unless there's something that machine offers that is above and beyond just what the old thing did. In which case, you're patenting that above and beyond element, not the old process.
This reminds me of a case that I read a while back now, so I don't remember all of the details, but essentially it was a patent for taking a previously isolated gene and putting it into a new organism, and I was absolutely baffled that this had gotten past the non-obvious test, because as a person who has a degree in genetics, it struck me as the most obvious thing in the world to take a gene that was in one organism and put it in another organism. It's called cloning a gene. You do it, you know, every day in genetics labs, and you do it for any number of reasons. But so it's, you know, one of those things where back then when this was patented, it wasn't necessarily obvious, or at the very least, it wasn't obvious to put this particular gene in that particular organism to a particular result.
I guess the oral arguments, as oral arguments tend to be, didn't necessarily go the way either side really hoped they would, in that the judges, the justices really kept interrupting, had their own ideas about how things should go, and this is kind of how oral arguments generally go.
There was one really interesting point that the respondents made during oral arguments, and they were discussing, I think this happened early when Attorney Stewart was presenting the respondent's case, and one of the justices had inquired as to, well, why don't we just come out and say business methods are just categorically not patentable? And I thought his response really brought to light the problem that we're dealing with in terms of statutory language and the concept of what the correct way might be to rule on this case. And he says, so, and I'm kind of reading this right out of the block here, right out of the transcript, excuse me. And he says, so to say that business method patents are categorically ineligible for patent protection would eliminate new machines, including programmed computers, that are useful because of their contributions to the operation of businesses. And similarly, the court, the Federal Circuit, in other cases, has held that a claim to new and innovative computer software may be held patentable as a process, as a method of accomplishing a particular task through the use of a computer and those business-related tasks. So to say that business methods were ruled out would itself be a fairly sweeping holding. And that seems to sort of get at what the problem is that the justices are now grappling with. It seems kind of clear, at least to me, that the justices do not really like the Federal Circuit test. And it, you know, I'm going to agree with you, Ben, and I think that what they'll probably end up doing is overruling the Federal Circuit test and hopefully devising some sort of new test whereby you could make it so that inventions, including the implementation of software onto machines, are still held as patent eligible inventions, and they'd be potentially patentable under the act as it stands today. Interestingly, though, the justice has also noted that this might be a place where Congress can come in and clarify by making an amendment to the Patent Act as it stands, and that might fix a lot of these problems.
Sounds good. So I guess to recap with predictions, Ben, you've kind of said your prediction, but do you want to give a quick 20-second recap of it?
Yes. It was also what Dave just said, which was that they're going to keep on saying that the patent, that the subject matter in Bilski, this process, isn't patentable, and then they're going to either devise a new test or just say that the old test is wrong, the machine and transformation test is wrong, and that we should go back to, you know, the law before Bilski.
Well, gosh, that's pretty much my prediction as well. So we're all on the same page, which means we're all blissfully correct or terribly wrong.
One final point just before we move on, and I think a lot of the public backlash that has come out in the last several years regarding the patentability of software inventions is that we see a lot of these patents that get issued these days, and when after they get issued, we see these almost ridiculous patent lawsuits that pop up, and people are like, what are you talking about? This patent was issued in, you know, 2005, but we're talking about a concept that is not novel at all because it was being practiced back in 1988. And so people sort of view it as, well, this is a soft, you know, the patent's overly broad, and we're looking at someone who's almost trolling on the patent and, you know, trying to use it as a weapon to sue some of the larger companies that have been using, you know, the invention or some component of the invention today. And probably, or at least in my eyes, I think that the problem is that the patent office is just, it's not efficient, and they don't have the resources to go through all of the prior art, and so they're not properly ruling on things that should be not patentable under the guise of either novelty or obviousness. And I think we really need to see some sort of change in the patent office, and I think that would fix a lot of the problems. But I absolutely think that software should be patentable. I think that it needs some form of robust IP protection that, at least similar to what patent provides, or exactly in terms of what patent provides.
Cool. Well, we will keep an eye on Bilski, and probably the court will write its opinion when? I guess next summer?
It will be out by July. It could come out pretty much any time between January and July, though. Yeah, there's no set date as to when they have to have them out by other than the end of the term.
Okay, so it'll be out for sure by July and possibly earlier, and we'll cover it when that comes out. But for now, there's nothing but anxious waiting for everyone involved. All right, our next story is the anti-counterfeiting trade agreement. There's been a lot of discussion on this in the blogosphere, and I guess most of it stems from the fact that it hasn't really been very transparently done. It's basically an international agreement to prevent counterfeiting, and it seems like it might be shaping up to sort of be an international DMCA, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, that passed in the United States. So I guess we don't really have anything hard in terms of what we can talk about, because we don't have the text of the document itself, because that's being kept pretty clearly under wraps, pretty strictly under wraps. But I think people wanted us to cover this topic because it has been sort of in the media and people are speculating all over the place, and perhaps it's worth grounding some of these speculations a bit in what might be possible and what might not be possible.
Right. So one of the big problems is that, as you mentioned, the negotiations are being held under wraps, and we're not actually seeing, or we don't know how accurate the documents that have gotten out so far actually are. And some people have even pointed out that the documents that were leaked could very well just be in some sort of draft form whereby the terms of ACTA are still kind of being hashed out, and it's not necessarily final. I think Ben pointed out in some emails that went back and forth between us that, you know, even if ACTA, even if we're looking at what will be the final provisions in ACTA, it's still subject to approval through the Senate and by the President too, I believe. And before it would actually be enforceable, at least, or at least until the United States becomes a party to the agreement.
Right. So on the procedural notes there, if it's an actual genuine treaty, the President would sign it, and then it would be subject to a 2/3 approval vote by the Senate. The President is also eligible to allowed to unilaterally enter into what's called an executive agreement. But either way, there's a chance, depending on how the treaty is written, that the legislature would have to enact the provisions of the treaty. So there are other treaties to which the United States is a party that aren't what's called self-executing. So despite the fact that the United States has signed the treaty and it's been approved, none of the parts of the treaty are in effect because no legislation was passed to enact those treaties. And that very well could be the case here. So we're many steps away from having anything new in the United States.
I think what bothers people, too, is the fact that there's a strong lack of public participation in what the terms of ACTA might potentially be, and that frightens a lot of people. What makes this a little bit different than some of the other international intellectual property agreements that we already have that are in place and that the U.S. is a party to is that I think you mentioned, Ben, Dominic, I'm sorry, that this is going to create some sort of global DMCA. And also, interestingly, there are supposedly, based on the leaked documents, proposed liability implications for internet service providers, whereby that the internet service providers will be compelled under the act to almost police copyright matters.
So that's where a lot of this debate is coming up. And I'm going to say that, again, we know very little about what the actual language is going to be. Cory Doctorow took the view that the ISPs are going to have to take an affirmative policing role and that they're going to have to, you know, make sure that all of the content that, you know, either people have access to or that they are hosting is doesn't infringe copyright. Ars Technica took a look at the same, you know, provisions that Cory Doctorow looked at and said, well, it looks here much more like that. The ISPs are going to get a safe harbor, like the DMC safe harbor, and they're going to have to enact provisions subject similar to what they currently have to do under the DMCA safe harbor. They're going to have methods in place for takedown notice. They're going to have methods in place to ban users who are repeat offenders.
Right, and I think internet service providers, the ISP definition that we're really talking about is a little bit broader than just encompassing companies like Comcast and Verizon, which provide internet access services. It's, internet service providers would also be read to include online service providers, I think, like websites similar to YouTube or Vo or other companies that are providing some sort of service to other people, right?
Flickr, yeah. Anything with some sort of community uploading could potentially fall under that umbrella.
I'm not terribly concerned about the concept of a global DMCA. I mean, what we're talking about is the parties in the U.S. would then have, assuming that a bunch of countries sign on to this, right, parties in the U.S. would have some sort of legal mechanism to enforce certain rights abroad in other countries to protect their intellectual property. I think despite all the backlash about the DMCA we've seen since its enactment in 1998, it's worked pretty well, and the safe harbor provisions are maybe not exactly the way that we would want them written, but they're still pretty good. I know that the process does get abused a bit, or at least it has the potential for abuse, like we see with DMCA takedown notices on YouTube. It's been used as just an effective tool to kill user-generated content because no one wants to send counter notices, or maybe they're not familiar with the processes. That said, though, I think that the concept of providing a safe harbor in terms of what service providers can do to shield themselves from liability is still fairly robust by itself. And I don't know that, you know, enforcing a DMCA worldwide is all that bad. People are probably a little bit more concerned too about anti-circumvention provisions like we have here in the U.S. whereby if you try to circumvent some sort of technical measure that prohibits or governs the access of individuals to copyrighted work, then you have an anti-circumvention violation that is has some sort of some liability under under the law.
Even if you were breaking through that anti-circumvention technology for the purposes of fair use,
that's one of the big shortcomings
of the DMCA, that fair use is no defense to circumventing copyright protection. Even if you had the right to access the material, the fact that you circumvented the copyright protection puts you in a bad spot, to put it mildly.
Right, and I don't think there's any evidence, at least from what I've read, that the current, I mean, again, there's so little information about what's actually in this treaty. Yeah. It doesn't seem like the anti-circumvention issues are, the anti-circumvention procedures and protections are what's getting in there. It looks to be more the safe harbor and the notice and takedown. But again, there's so little here. And I agree that notice and takedown worldwide isn't necessarily a bad thing. It's a great tool for copyright owners. What I'd like to see, if that does get enacted worldwide, is also the damages provision for clearly unlawful takedowns that you have in the U.S., and which has been a relatively powerful tool in at least helping to curtail or slow down the pace of illegal takedowns.
Can you talk more about the damages provision for illegal takedowns?
Yes. So if it's clear that the takedown notice had no basis in law, then the person who was subject to the takedown notice can sue the person who sent the takedown notice and ask for, I believe it's statutory damages for...
So for example, I just want to give an example to illustrate. Say somebody is in a political campaign and he, or let's say she, uploads a video criticizing their opponent. It's all original work. Their opponent files a takedown notice and YouTube sort of knee-jerk takes it down, even though there was nothing in there that would have in any way created a takedown. You're saying then that this spurned politician can turn around and...
So they can sue the politician who sent the takedown notice and get some measure of damages for essentially what amounts to a free speech violation, although by a private actor in that case. I think there are very few published cases about this. One case where this did happen, I think it was Diebold. Somebody published an email sent by a Diebold employee and published it online, and Diebold sent a takedown notice, and they got it taken offline. And the problem is that Diebold doesn't own a copyright in its employees' emails, and as a result, the takedown notice had absolutely no legal merit to it, and there was some award of damages and attorney fees. Attorney fees is very important here because attorney fees is what's going to make these cases worth bringing, because the attorney who brings it can get their money back from litigating the case.
Yeah, what's more problematic to me is that the way that this disproportionately places the burden on individual users. So you're talking about a political campaign. It's more likely that you would have the person who had uploaded that video, assuming that he had full right to do so, he's probably more likely to pursue some sort of damages suit for the unlawful takedown. But if it's just an individual user, if it's some 14-year-old that's sitting at home that's uploading his own creative content that might potentially fall under the guise of fair use, that person might not be terribly familiar with the procedures of a counter takedown notice and certainly might not be aware of the potential damages provisions that he could pursue under the DMCA in the U.S. And with the effect that the takedowns then might have on those individual users is a chilling effect, because it becomes then a tool whereby the content holders can just send out mass numbers of, assuming that they're, you know, they comport with the requirements under the DMCA for what a takedown notice has to have, they can send out mass takedown notices and get content taken down, and those users, because they don't know enough about the process or the law, won't do anything for it, and so then we're seeing the elimination of what would otherwise be lawful material on user-generated content websites.
Yeah, incidentally, there's a website that for $39.95 will guarantee that your stolen content be removed from a website, or else they'll give you a refund. I just saw that. Oh. I thought I'd mention it.
Okay. But I guess to sort of wrap up this story, the ACTA, the Anti-Counterfeiting Trade Agreement, we just don't really know enough to make any broad statements, but it's unlikely that anything draconian will emerge because Congress has to, or the Senate actually has to ratify the treaty, or, I mean, there's going to be some public review at some point.
There will be, but the, you know, again, the people who are really taking place in the negotiations, and then the content holder groups who are lobbying for particular provisions within ACTA are really the people who are who have more power or more leverage in this to influence what the provisions actually say. So then you have that lack of public participation, which scares people, because I think it's safe to say that one of the most influential groups in the history of revising copyright law have been the content holders. And so people are just concerned that you're going to get some type of international trade agreement which is unduly prohibitive of copyright law, and it just eschews the way that we look at the concepts of fair use, and the act itself will require changes in U.S. law, which will affect us too.
All right. On that note, we'll keep you posted about ACTA, and if something new comes up, we will let you know. It looks like, as with most international agreements, this is going to take a long time, so it might be a while. Our last story is about pancakes, or more seriously, it's about how updating your Facebook status, complaining about, I believe the exact phrasing is, where are my IHOP? Within the context of a message that he said that he was on the phone with this fat chick, where are my IHOP? I'm sorry, but I'm not culturally sophisticated enough to understand that reference. But nonetheless, that particular Facebook update at that particular time, at a particular location, saved Mr. Rodney Bradford from robbery charges because the district attorney in Harlem was looking at him as a potential robber. He basically said, no, look, I updated my Facebook. At the time you said I was robbing this guy, and I was updating this Facebook from, I believe, his father's. Was that correct? His
yeah, father's? You got it yeah. backwards. So he was in Harlem, and there was a robbery in Brooklyn.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. Carry on, sir.
Okay. So basically, the district attorney was like, well, if you've updated Facebook, well, it's clear that you weren't robbing anyone if you were sitting in an apartment updating Facebook.
Yeah, in defense to the district attorney in this case, they did subpoena records from Facebook, which yes. proved that he did, in fact, update at that time from a computer in Harlem.
Well, not necessarily he.
Well, somebody updated
somebody
his
logged
Facebook
into his
account.
Facebook account.
Yeah.
From that computer, yes. Somebody being the kind of... Anything. All likelihood, possibly, most likely him. But not necessarily. There's no way of confirming that. Well, Ben, you're the expert on evidence. What does this portend for the future of criminals and social networkers?
Yeah, experts going a little far. I don't want to represent anything to the bar that I can't actually back up. But I found this really interesting. In fact, one of my first tweets when I joined Twitter, I guess almost 2 years ago now, was, you know, how long is it going to be? What?
I'm just laughing at that. Congratulations, how long you've been on Twitter. It's
yeah.
clearly that you're on
Thanks.
The forefront
I was,
of the story.
I joined
in the beginning.
It was right before it really took off. Although it's been really taking off for a while now.
Was that
anyway.
South by Southwest 2007?
Yeah, something like that. Anyway. Totally off track for a minute there. One of my first tweets was about how long it's going to be before a status update makes it as a into a murder trial or some sort of criminal trial. Or really any trial, but I was really more concerned with criminal trials. Specifically because generally, at least from the view of the government, you can get in any statement that the defendant made as long as the defendant was made voluntarily and not in violation of constitutional rights. So if I, you know, posted something on my Facebook account that says, you know, going to rob a chick, and then, you know, there's a robbery of a woman at some point, they could, you know, put me on trial and they could use that statement against me, both because it's a what's called a statement of a party opponent, and it's because it would be a statement against my material interest. And these are just different ways that you can get evidence in, specifically evidence called hearsay. So many people are familiar with the term hearsay, but in criminal law and in evidence law in general, it has a very specific meaning, What it means is it's any out-of-court statement that was entered into evidence to prove the truth of the matter. So even if I'm on the stand and I'm testifying, I can't necessarily say, so I can't necessarily talk about what I said earlier because I'd be testifying about an out-of-court statement. And as long as I was introducing that to prove the truth of the matter, then it's hearsay. Even though it's not, even though it wasn't, I heard something and then I'm saying it, I said it. But it's still hearsay and it's generally inadmissible, and you have to get it into one of these little nooks and crannies into evidence law. Now, the reason why this case is interesting, this Facebook case, is because it would have been very difficult to get the to get this into evidence, to get that Facebook status into evidence at a trial, from the standpoint of the defendant.
And why would it have been difficult to get into evidence from the standpoint of the defendant?
Thank you. I just needed somebody to break me up. I'd been talking for a while. It would have been difficult to get in because it would have been, although, never mind. I'm reconsidering that statement now, because you're not trying to prove that he was. Yeah, I'm thinking about this as I go now. So you're not trying to prove that he was concerned about the location of his pancakes. You're using it to prove where he was, which I guess isn't proving the truth of the matter. It may not be that difficult, but you'd still have to get somebody to testify, and there'd be a question. Testify as to what the status update says, and there'd be a question as to who posted it, whether or not it was actually him. And you'd need some sort of testimony that, I mean, even if the testimony was that he's the only person who has access to the account, or generally people don't let other people post status updates. But let's say, for the sake of argument now, that I post something on my Twitter account that says, right now I'm at IHOP. And IHOP in Harlem, and a robbery is being committed in Brooklyn, then you may have a little more difficulty because the statement is being entered to prove where I was at the time. And in that case, it is exactly your alibi statement. And that'd be more difficult to get in, I think. Do any of you agree with me on the fact that that statement would be more difficult to get in than where's my pancakes?
Yeah, I think I agree, based on my imperfect understanding of hearsay law.
Yeah, I mean, the flip side of that is it could be a present sense impression, which is a really weird exception to hearsay, where if I say that, if I say to a group of people, I'm going right back, I'm going out to my car, that's admissible for some incredibly stupid reason that I don't understand the reasoning of the court in that case, as to why that fits into what's called a present sense impression. It's like the present state of mind is what it actually is. My state of mind is that I'm going out to my car. I don't think that works. You're introducing it to prove the truth of the matter that at that time I was about to go out to my car. But Dominic, were you going to jump in and say something?
No. That's a pretty good summary. I guess what does this particular case imply for the future of I mean, are potential robbers going to make sure they update? I mean, it seems like all you really need is an accomplice willing to update Facebook for you, and you can replicate this.
You're going to have issues as of proof in all of these cases. I mean, I don't think every assistant district attorney is going to be as noble as this one was and just dismiss the charge because there's a Facebook status update. You're going to have district attorneys who still think that this is the guy and, may think that, he got somebody to update it for him or somehow, rigged his computer to do a mobile, to do an update, automatically when he was away.
Scheduled update.
Yeah, and I think we're vastly overestimating the intelligence of criminals. Because they're most of them really not that bright. Won't be thinking far enough ahead to put something like this into place.
Yeah, there was a quote in that New York Times article, I think, where some commenter that was quoted within the article had said, teenagers these days are incredibly intelligent, based on things that go on the internet because they're always on the internet. And I sort of laughed at that because I was like, well, there's a lot of teenagers out there, but I don't know that that necessarily makes them technically savvy enough to engineer, complicated ways of creating alibis based on status updates on social networking sites like Facebook. But all the same, I guess there's some merit to it that it, there is potentially a way that someone could create alibis based on their Facebook status updates. But I still think, though, that there's probably other ways of a district attorney proving that it was a manufactured alibi and not a legitimate one.
Yeah, I mean, witnesses for one.
witnesses. You could subpoena the records from, for instance, IP address logs and stuff like that. So you could find out where the, you know, where the computer was located that actually sent the update, whether it was from a mobile device, whether it was from a desktop computer, maybe even. And I just think that there are a number of other ways that a clever DA could go about disproving somebody's manufactured alibi that they, you know, that they submitted to Facebook.
Yeah, that leads me to an interesting kind of side note here. Somebody on, I think it was Floss Weekly, said in this most recent episode, you know, imagine how different the internet today would be if the default with which Apache shipped was not to log IP addresses. I mean, as far as the amount of information that we send out there, the ability of the federal government and state governments to subpoena that information to figure out, you know, who's posting what, it would just be a vastly different internet if that one default was, you know, flipped the other way to not log IP addresses.
Hmm. Yeah, that's true. I mean, from a technical standpoint, I could think of a number of reasons why somebody who is administering a web server would want to have IP address logs anyways, even if it wasn't a default setting, and they might come up with their own way to create an IP address logging system.
Right.
Right.
The fact that it's default means that it happens by default, whether you think about it or not. That's a pretty profound point, I guess. What would the internet look like if it wasn't logged by default?
That's true.
Yeah, I mean, and then you'd at the same time, you'd have to promulgate that thing through all of the blogging software that automatically logs IP addresses, all of the forum software that automatically catalogs IP addresses. But, you know, it gives you a very different picture of how the internet might turn out.
So just as a sort of a little tangential point, I think this is the first case that we've seen this used as a alibi, you know, to defend that. For a defendant to use to say that he was not the person who actually perpetrated the crime that he was being alleged that he was alleged that he did, but we have seen online posts in general used all over the place for other criminal actions. I can think and civil actions too. I mean, I can think of a number of articles that I've read that talk about the usage of Facebook status updates and a particular post being used to discredit a witness's testimony throughout a civil trial, or there was even one case involving it was a MySpace posting from a nursing student, and she was discussing something that had occurred when she was working at a hospital, which was in the course of her education, and the school had used that as grounds to either suspend or expel her from the school. And so then the whole pinnacle of the case was all about what she had posted and whether or not the school had reasonable grounds to dismiss her as a student from the school. But this is certainly, again, the first case I think we've seen where it's being used as some sort of alibi.
Yeah, I will
there isn't really a whole lot that prevents, under the federal rules of civil procedure or criminal procedure, that prevents the usage of electronic data, in other words, to be used as evidence within a case.
I very often find myself thinking much more deeply about status updates on Facebook, which I do very infrequently now, or even Twitter updates, you know, out of, you know, what are the implications of this? If I'm, you know, saying that I'm in Central Square now, you know, what does that mean? That means that, God forbid, if somebody tries to pin me on something, they can say that I'm in Central Square. Or, you know, if I tweet every Friday that I'm in Central Square in Cambridge, and then one Friday I don't tweet that I'm in Central Square, you know, what is that? What would that show at a trial? You know, that my routine was broken, that, you know, that weekend, that week I wasn't in Central Square because I was off committing some heinous murder. It's
not necessarily, but potentially.
Yeah, I mean, that's one inference that you can draw from that evidence.
This is why I only tweet in Facebook status about intellectual topics.
So. That might have its own implications too, actually.
Certainly, but free speech law is a little, or used to be, hopefully continues to be, a pretty strong protection there. So,
I don't know. You could still get an intellectual tweet brought in as evidence against you. It's just hard to be relevant. More hard to it would be less relevant than my tweets generally are.
Yeah.
Any other thoughts on this before we close it out, guys?
No, not really. I mean, it was an interesting story to read, though. And I was a little disappointed that this guy was so interested in pancakes, I would have preferred waffles myself.
I love waffles.
Yeah, I'm actually kind of curious that the New York Times summary of the story, they don't even mention the fact that they provide a screenshot of his Facebook page, which says, on the phone with this fat chick, where are my IHOP? But they say, they kind of translate this for some reason after saying it's a navel-gazing cryptic Facebook status update as where are my pancakes? I'm not sure that's an accurate translation, but it's interesting to see how they kind of didn't take what he wrote at face value and just kind of read what they wanted to onto it.
Oh, so in other words, it might have actually been waffles that he was interested in.
You never know. Yes. I mean, IHOP does have waffles. So, on that tasty note, that concludes this podcast for November 17th. This was podcast 25. So the next podcast, 26, is going to be our 6-month anniversary. So thank you all for listening. And if you have any thoughts or comments, please feel free to email us at podcast@technicallylegal.org or comment on our website at technicallylegal.org or tweet us at @techlegal. Thanks for listening. I'm Dominic Rabier.
I'm Ben Snitkoff.
And I'm David O'Brien.
Have a great one. Technically Legal Uncut.
Anybody have stuff they want to go over before we get started?
Today on Technically Legal, we'll be talking about your favorite sci-fi series as they apply to the Bilski case.
That would be awesome.
You see, Justice Roberts, he's like Kara Thrace.
And find out... What's that?
Dominic just broke something.
Actually, nothing broke, but...
Anyways, you could find
I'm
out...
I'm updating Facebook, it's okay.
Dominic broke the podcast.